These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit, a unifying force. Come on, move with the spirit. Stand up, clap your hands. Move with the rhythms, get down.
From WSNT 90.5 FM, a broadcasting service and NPR affiliate of Winston-Salem State University, welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, history is a tool for organizing with Obi Igbuna Jr. Africa World Now Project is next. Analyzing the conditions which dictate the systems and institutions which also perpetuate inequities require the ability to identify a map. It requires the science and art of identifying genealogy. It requires the necessity to remember, but not simply for remembrance. Africana peoples oscillate between variations of a peculiar aversion to history or wanting to know everything about history, specifically Africana history. But few understand the purpose of history or its use as a tool for organizing. Today, we will listen to a recent conversation I had with Obi Igbuna Jr., where we explore the question, phase one in a series of conversations which ask, how can history be a tool for organizing? It is one thing to know bits and pieces of historical content, but a historical consciousness uncultivated into a critical consciousness is without purpose. The notion of a tree without roots is often given as the axiom to grounding Africana peoples on a path to learning history. But what is important to engage is the question for what? To what ends? For what purpose? Knowing your roots, i.e. history, does not necessitate purpose. Unorganized information is not knowledge. Knowledge is only power when organized, intentionally organized. To move to the next level of historical consciousness is to evolve it into a critical Africana consciousness. Association is not enough to be considered a functional component of a movement, and proximity does not guarantee contribution. One has to struggle with ideas through practice, crafting this into a praxis for expressed objectives in order to find continuity with the past, to understand the present, ultimately leading to creating a future. Obi Igbuna Jr. was born in London, England, and raised in Washington, D.C., spending time in Nigeria. Obi is a founding member of the Pan-African Liberation Organization, established in Washington, D.C. from 1990 to 2007. In addition to organizing and speaking engagements, Obi is a journalist, Africana history teacher, and playwright. Obi is also correspondent to the Herald, Zimbabwe's national newspaper, and the first U.S. correspondent in the country's 32 years as an independent nation. Obi has taught African history at Roots Public Charter School since 1990 and has also taught at Ujima School and Northwestern High School in Prince George's County. He is the current African history teacher for the Sankofa Homeschool Collective. In addition to this, Obi is a founding member and executive director of Mass Emphasis Children's History and Theater Company. He has also written several resolutions and appeals to the United Nations, World Health Organization, and Southern African Development Community covering issues ranging from HIV/AIDS in Zimbabwe to police brutality issues in the United States. Obi has also organized around calling for the unconditional and immediate lifting of US-EU sanctions on Zimbabwe that went to the White House, US Senate, and Congress. Lastly, in addition to forging his own path, Obi worked directly with Kwame Ture the last 8 years of his life and is the son of Obi Igbuna, who was a Nigerian-born novelist, playwright, and political activist, leading member of the Universal Colored People's Association and the British Black Power Black Panther movement. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Enjoy the program. We are joined by Obi Igbuna Jr. to have a wide-ranging discussion about the use of African history in liberation, or as a tool for liberation. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
How you been holding up in the context of all of the things that have been going on, with COVID, the insurrections and all of the stuff that's been going on?
Just doing as much as we can to advance Africa's struggle for liberation forward. Right. Which history obligates us to do.
Right. And so let's pick up with that particular point, because as those who listen to our programs, one of the things that we like to do is to just jump right in the middle of a conversation and really kind of map it out. And one of the things that I really want to map out in this conversation, of course, is the notion of the continuity of thinking through struggle, and also how that merges with practice, or merges with the practice of struggle. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we've had a conversation before this, and one of the things that I mentioned to you is that, reading Walter Rodney, particularly African History in the Service of Black Liberation, it really dawned on me that we really should structure our conversation and move out from that. And with that being said, how can history be used as a tool for organizing, or specifically African history?
When we focus on historical responsibility, being a product of the 1990s generation like I am, we had a split there. There were those who embraced a concept and a model, which was a carryover from the 1960s, those who subscribed to Gandhi's model of leadership. And we're talking titles, we're talking accolades, and what have you. And then there were those of us who simply wanted to take a look at expanding on the contributions of those who came before us and correcting their mistakes in the process. So if that's your approach, history is an invaluable weapon. So if I'm focusing on police terrorism, eradicating it, I'm going to look at the history of all the organized formations who have done that. I'm a children's playwright. So obviously I have to look at the Harlem Renaissance. Obviously I have to look at the Black Arts Movement. Obviously I have to look at the African Cultural Renaissance, spearheaded by Akme Sekou Touré in Guinea and Catherine Dunham, and dealing with her work in the Caribbean. So any organizer that's serious about organizing and serious about taking things to new unprecedented heights, they're going to study as much as they can, but study for the purpose of having it be illustrated through the execution.
And one of the points that I think that we can kind of unwrap here, or dig into, or unfold here is, and as we're thinking about this notion of how can history be a tool for organizing, it's one thing to know bits and pieces of historical content, right? Mm-hmm. But a historical consciousness not cultivated or uncultivated into a critical consciousness is a tree without roots or purpose, right? So knowing your roots or history does not necessitate purpose. What is your response to that in the context of a long genealogy and situating the fact that you are yourself a part of a continuity of those who were attempting to move a historical consciousness into a critical consciousness with purpose?
Okay, let's do a good example. Last year was the 25th anniversary of the first Million Man March. On behalf of the Pan-African Student Youth Movement, I had the honor and privilege of working on the National Youth Organizing Committee. So one of our main focus was the Day of Absence and Day of Action. So when we were doing that, we went back and studied Lucy Parsons and the role that she played in the May Day demonstrations in this country challenging the 14-hour workday. We had to go and study the Convention People's Party Positive Action Campaign that resulted in a transfer of power for Sajapo Dr. Kwame Nkrumah and the Convention People's Party. We studied that. We had to study what Sekou Touré and the Democratic Party of Guinea did in 1946 to 1958, the 12 years of nonstop, consistent, sustainable, direct action We had to study what Lumumba did with the Congolese National Movement in the 50s and the 60s. So we studied that for the purpose of looking at the strategical and tactical aspect. So a lot of people, when they come to talk about history, they're dealing with ideology, they're dealing with philosophy, they're not dealing with methodology. And that is why we have such a gap between the execution of the idea and the articulation of the idea. So in order for us to come up with the concept that we did, shut down America, in order for us to get millions and millions of young people not to go to work and not to go to school that day, we were looking at those strategies. We looked at the September Revolution that Muammar Gaddafi and the young people in Libya carried out in 1969 also. So that's a practical example of knowing that you have an objective, knowing that you have a goal, and studying carefully and studying critically other people in at a different historical space who may have used those methods, and those methods came to bear fruit. I work in the field of education. I've been teaching African history to children for 30 years now, 31. This year makes 31 years. So obviously we have to take a look at some of the work that people have done that's very groundbreaking in the field of education in different places. We have the Mass Emphasis Children's History and Theater Company and the Mass Emphasis Positive Action and Creativity Youth Brigade. So obviously we would have to study the Young Pioneer Institute of the Convention People's Party during Nkrumah's day. Obviously we would have to study the pioneers of the revolution under Thomas Sankara in Burkina Faso. Obviously we would, we're looking to have a relationship with La Comunita, the Children's National Theater Assembling in Cuba. So this way, we have a relationship with them, and through working with them and them sharing their experiences with us, it helps us grow, it helps us evolve, it helps us maximize our potential. So when you're organizing and you're executing these ideas and you're working, and when you're working on certain projects, you take a look at the people who were doing it before. In the 90s, we had a project in the Pan-African student youth movement called the King Muhammad Anti-Military Project. Our work, our coming to frontline struggle in the 1990s, we fight the National Guard in Virginia Beach in 1989. We shut down Washington, D.C. over the Rodney King verdict. Well, obviously, we were involved in Cuba very early. We were working with all three liberation movements since what's called South Africa very early. We worked with the Somali National Alliance at the time where the Clinton administration was targeting Idid, labeling him a warlord. We were working with the Eritrean, we were working with the National Union of Eritrean Students as early as 1991. So obviously, by working with these folks, we're getting a chance to look at militarism, whether we're looking at sanctioning, whether we're looking at environmental warfare. We went to Panama to take a look at how the military base in Panama had polluted the land, and found out that Panama was one of the places where they were stashing Agent Orange that they didn't get to use against the mighty people of Vietnam. So going through that process and studying those things, we were studying those things, we were picking up these tidbits of history to use it as a weapon to develop a project to change the course of how our people look at militarism on the police level, on the local level, on the national level, and on the global level. And because we've always had a Pan-Africanist focus, that's how we always looked at things. So the study can be very rewarding, because when you're trying to execute certain things, so they go hand in hand, but the prerequisite is you're studying these things for one main focus. You plan to do some organizing, critical organizing, sustainable organizing around all this information you digest.
And that becomes important in the context of the continuities of struggle. Yes. And what I'm hearing here is something that, you know, I attempt to actualize and study, but also in practice as well, is really mapping continuities, which brings me, you know, to an important particular point here in the context of the work that you have been doing over the past, you know, 30 plus years, but also what informed that work? What aspects of history, what aspects of struggle, what aspects of the conditions that informed your development and mm-hmm. having this particular platform for this sustained amount of time?
Oh, like I said, I always was taught that struggle was an obligation and not an option. as we're sitting here having this conversation on a day that U.S. imperialism is acknowledging Dr. King like they're doing us a favor, he himself said, life's most urgent and persistent question is, what are you doing for others? And at the beginning of the 90s generation, we were still embracing the adage of the 60s generation about giving back. But when we took a look at the people who we were attempting to emulate, who we gained inspiration from, we recognized that you had to give first, you had to give foremost, you had to give always. And the other thing that we realized too, I had a chance, my father is the co-founder of the Black Panther Party in London and the co-founder of the Black Power Movement in London. But one of the things I realized too is I had a chance to meet Ayanna Gregory at a very young age. I had a chance to meet Raz Baraka at a very young age, now the mayor of Newark. And a few others who had parents who had frontline experience, unique frontline experience, impeccable frontline experience. But one of the things we recognized is when we looked at things that way, when we looked at historical responsibility, the historical responsibility belongs to all of us, whether you're the child of Malcolm, the child of Martin, the child of Walter Rodney, the child of Biko, the child of Sobukwe, or you're the child of a prostitute, the child of a cocaine dealer, the child of a dope dealer, because the frontline of struggle is the ultimate equalizer, regardless of your educational pedigree, regardless of your intellectual acumen, regardless of your gender, regardless of your spiritual beliefs, the front line is the equalizer, and history supports that. The front line for our liberation struggle is the only place that a sharecropper like Fannie Lou Hamer and Dr. King can be loved the same. The front line is the only place where a former pimp and a former burglar and a former hustler like Malcolm can share the same space with PhDs like Du Bois, PhDs like Dr. Woodson. This is why the front line is beautiful. On the front line, you may make certain distinctions, but you only make them because when you're attempting to recruit Africans from different demographics, you want to find someone who's just like them. So if we're doing work in prisons, Malcolm and George Jackson all day long is who we talk to those brothers about. If we're talking to journalists, you talk to them about Blyden, you talk to them about George Padmore, you talk to them about J.A. Rogers, you talk to them about Ida B. Wells, you talk to them about Daisy Bates. If you're dealing with women, oh Lord, the laundry list goes without saying. If you want to talk about the women in Eritrea, where 33% of the guerrillas were women. If you want to talk about the National Association of Colored Women. If you want to talk about this, if you are talking to young girls who want to dance, you got to talk to them about Catherine Dunham and Pearl Primus. If you talk to people who say, well, Christianity is my thing, where do you want to go? You want to go with Bishop Alexander Walters, you want to go with Alexander Crummell, you want to go with Absalom Jones and Richard Allen, you want to talk about Benjamin Mays, you want to talk about Howard Thurman. So one of the things that we've learned through the years is if we're really focusing in on getting people to make a transition from observing struggle to becoming active in struggle, you identify people whose life parallels to their life, and that way you can get them to come on in. If you're an artist and you say, well, what can I do as an artist? That list is long as well. So that's the way we have to approach it. That way everybody understands that they have a role to play. And not only that, we recognize how we can utilize their skills, because one of the most important aspects of a struggle against capitalism and imperialism, we have to overemphasize that the human resource is the most important resource, because the human resource determines what happens with the material resource.
Let's dig in that. Let's unpack that particular notion that you are laying out here, particularly this notion of this human resources, understanding one's role and responsibility or one's place into struggle. And I was thinking about this in the context of this notion, I'm in academia, but also I do a lot outside of academia in the context of an internationalist frame of reference. And I was thinking about this notion of individuals who consider themselves to be scholar activists, particularly in the academy. And I'm thinking about folk that such as C.L.R. James, right, who was a thinker in the context of formulating strategy and formulating a particular theoretical understanding of the conditions within which African people find themselves across the world. Mm-hmm. And then I was thinking about people who were actually fighting or moving on the front line, as you articulate. And what I'm thinking here is that when we talk about this human resource and struggle, how important is it for us to understand not to reproduce these Western notions of individualism through a person trying to encapsulate this catch-all, scholar activist or activist thinker? Could you talk a little bit more about unpacking?
Well, it's funny that you say that because for me, people do it all the time, and you have to pick your battles when you're having quality exchanges. I don't like to be referred to as an activist, and I'm an organizer. And the reason that I think that there's a difference is because an individual can be active, but your activity should be connected to an organized formation. I heard this white woman one day say she was an environmental activist, and I wanted to know what environmental organization she belonged to. She said, I just clean up after my dog when I take it for a walk, so I help make the environment a better place. So in her mind, she's an environmental activist. So when I heard that, I said, wow, we really have to think about that. So when people say that they're an activist, then I need to know what organization they belong to, or what organization are they a support system of? Because what you end up finding out is you hear individuals who claim to have a theory, claim to have an analysis, claim to have a newfound idea. But if we go back and look, what they're espousing is something that certain organizations have been pushing for 100 years. So now you have all of these people under the guise of generational wealth talking about they have an economic blueprint. But when you hear them elaborate on what they're talking about, Booker T. Washington was dealing with that with the National Negro Business League. At the early part of the 20th century, they may not know that's where the ideas emanate from. So a lot of these individuals opportunistically pass off agendas of organizations as their own idea, like they've discovered the cure for cancer. So we have to safeguard against that. You said academia. Are you talking about all educational institutions, or are you zeroing in on universities in particular?
And that's a very good question, because we usually hear this term, and particularly in elite universities, right?
I mean, because what ends up happening is you have a lot of sisters and brothers who are on these universities campuses, and I have to say, they behave like watchdogs, and they're the buffer between the administration and the students. And nowadays, with the advent of technology, they'll show Mukasa Dada, formerly known as Willie Ricks, on YouTube to the students, but they won't bring him to the campus to engage the students. They'll show Kwame Ture on YouTube, but they won't invite the All African People's Revolutionary Party on their campus. They'll show the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan on YouTube, but they won't invite the Nation of Islam on their campus. So they call themselves introducing the students to struggle, but they don't bring the organizers who represent these organizations to the campuses to see if they can have a relationship with the students in their organizational capacities, be if they work in the Caribbean Student Union, if they work at the African Student Union, if they work in student government, or if they do like we did, you create an organization that's not associated with the university pecking order, but you represent that demographical space, and you create an organization. So I went into a particular professor's class with my son because I was teaching students at Dunbar last year. So they wanted to take a trip to this campus because of its historical significance. I go in there, he refers to me as a legend when I walk in the door, but he's never invited me there to talk to the students. So my point is, a lot of these professors who will call themselves activists, but they can't show you what practical support they give to the organized formations that we have out here. And what some of them do through their writing, through their research, through their books, is they try to pass off the decades of work as organizations as their own work. So if that's what we're doing, then we're trashing and degrading the culture of resistance. And when you begin to develop a subculture that is that diverts attention away from resistance, that is set out to now sabotage the resistance, water down the resistance, then you're an enemy of the resistance, period.
You're actually re-inscribing the power relations that you claim to be actually fighting against, which goes back to my initial thinking about this, is, you know, particularly in the human capital in the context of struggle. but in the context of African struggle, which was communal at its root, meaning that people knew their they had tools that they brought. Now, this doesn't mean that people were not able to evolve to be in different capacities at different times. Whether you study, then you go struggle, then you learn, then you write. Let's talk about, because it's very important. You mentioned student unions. You mentioned unions itself. And one of the things that, you know, I think about often in the context of struggle, particularly in the African world, on the African continent, but also in the diaspora, whether it's in Brazil or in other places, the role of student unions struggle, particularly in anti-colonialist struggle on the continent of Africa, and the differences of student unions here in the United States. Could you talk a little bit about the role of students and student unions, continental, but also in the context of the diaspora as well?
Well, if you're talking about during the anti-colonial movement, we know the role of students. In a neo-colonialist situation, you know the role of students. Here in this country, many people, I want to give a shout out to Black Seeds Historical Calendar for bringing attention in their last year's edition to the Southern Negro Youth Congress. And I thought that that was fantastic on a multitude of levels. First of all, it challenged the notion of us continuing to treat the 1960s like the Garden of Eden in the Bible, like it's the beginning of our resistance. So the fact that they focused on an organization that was at its peak in the 1930s and the 1940s, that was fantastic on their part. For us, in terms of this country, of course, you know, one of the models would be the student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, of course. And that organization is interesting because of what happened, how it was created. It was activity that inspired that organization to be established. After Ella Baker saw 10,000 students march on DC in 1959, followed up by 26,000 students marching on DC in 1960, 70,000 students and youth going to jail in 1960 over the sit-in movement, she felt that SNCC should be created to give their organization, to ensure that that activity was sustained and it had some meaningful direction, short-term and long-term and what have you. So the student unions in this country, it depends how you want to approach it. If you're talking about the African student unions, what one of the things we know is that during the Homeland Security era, the African student unions are afraid to challenge U.S.-Africa policy because that's connected to their immigration status, which is connected to their class interests, which is connected to what their individual aspirations are. And then when they leave the African student unions, they end up ascending to the leadership of the civic associations of their communities. So they may go from the African student union at Howard to be the heads of the Nigerian Civic Association in Washington, or the Ethiopian Civic Association in Washington, or the Guinean Civic Association in Washington. And whenever those communities have weddings, whenever those communities have funerals, whenever those communities have graduations, they usually bring those people together. But quite naturally, if there's political unrest in those nations, they bring people together just to talk about the situation. But then what ends up happening is if there are people in those meetings who are espousing anti-imperialist ideas, anti-capitalist ideas, they will be, the State Department will be informed. Homeland Security will be informed. When we're talking about Caribbean student unions, one of the things that we know is when you look at the Caribbean historically, and especially now, there's a very strong labor union tradition. But the problem is that the labor unions in the Caribbean and the labor unions in Africa from the 1950s had a relationship with the International Labor Solidarity Committee, which is nothing but a front for the CIA. And as a matter of fact, it used to be the global component of the AFL-CIO, but now it is broken away. And the importance of that is they want that to be the vehicle of neocolonialism that they use in the Caribbean and they use in Africa to prevent national liberation movements from ever ascending like they did during the anti-colonial movement. So these are just some of the things that we have seen happen and we have seen unfold. Also, we see how imperialism, understanding the historical significance of youth, and in particular what you talked about, there are some peoples whose journeys and navigations they do not want to see. They don't want to see a continuum of it. They don't want to see people like Nkrumah, not just because of what he represented ideologically, but his journey coming to the United States, meeting CLR Jones.
We are listening to a recent conversation with Obi Igbuna Jr., where we're exploring history as a tool for organizing. Obi Igbuna Jr. was born in London, England, and raised in Washington, D.C., spending time in Nigeria. Obi is a founding member of the Pan-African Liberation Organization, established in Washington, D.C. from 1990 to 2007. In addition to organizing and speaking engagements, Obi is a journalist, Africana history teacher, and playwright. Obi is also correspondent to the Herald, Zimbabwe's national newspaper, and the first U.S. correspondent in the country's 32 years as an independent nation. Obi has taught African history at Roots Public Charter School since 1990 and has also taught at Ujima School and Northwestern High School in Prince George's County. He is the current African history teacher for the Sankofa Homeschool Collective. In addition to this, Obi is a founding member and executive director of Mass Emphasis Children's History and Theater Company. He has also written several resolutions and appeals to the United Nations, World Health Organization, and Southern African Development Community covering issues ranging from HIV/AIDS in Zimbabwe to police brutality issues in the United States. Obi has also organized around calling for the unconditional and immediate lifting of US-EU sanctions on Zimbabwe that went to the White House, US Senate, and Congress. Lastly, in addition to forging his own path, Obi worked directly with Kwame Ture the last 8 years of his life and is the son of Obi Igbuna, who was a Nigerian-born novelist, playwright, and political activist, leading member of the Universal Colored People's Association and the British Black Power Black Panther movement. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Enjoy the program.
To the United States, meeting CLR James, giving CLR James credit for teaching him how to organize underground, going to London, getting that experience through the 5th Pan-African Congress, and then going back, looking at the United Gold Coast Convention and says, this isn't a revolutionary vehicle, we need something new. Getting people out of that because of its limitations and starting the Convention People's Party. Looking at Eduardo Mondlane, how he was at Oberlin College and he ends up going back and Frelimo gets off the ground and we see what Frelimo does to Portuguese colonialism. So the Obama administration starts this thing called YALI, the Young African Leadership Institute. And that vehicle was established for the purpose to ensure you get no more Nkrumahs, you get no more Samora Machels, you get no more Amilcar Cabrals, who went to study in Portugal, was a co-founder of the MPLA, and the founder of the Party for the Independence of Cape Verde. So they want to use the students. We have said historically, students are the spark of our revolutions. Now they want students to be at the vanguard of redirecting us from revolution, almost creating what we now see today, an alternative to resistance that we can safely call alternative resistance, the same way you have alternative rock or alternative jazz and what have you. So it looks like resistance in form, but when you get close enough to it and you see what the fight is for, you realize that it has nothing to do with resistance at all. It is capitulation with high volume capitulation. And so that high volume capitulation is prevalent among student unions in Africa. That high volume capitulation is prevalent amongst student unions in the Caribbean. And those who truly want to reintroduce a certain revolutionary fervor, they have to watch their steps extremely carefully tonight.
And that's a very important point, particularly when you're talking about the continuities, but also the disruption in continuities, which also brings up, you know, again, as we've been kind of layering under our conversation, the importance of organizing and organizing it into an institutionalization or institutional form to be able to support continuously, because you mentioned something earlier, sustained organizing, sustained continued organizing against the conditions within which perpetuate and re-inscribe power relations that, you know, people say that they are fighting against. Talk a little bit more about, because one of the things I really want to get back to is, like, you know, your journalist background, but we'll move that, I'll push that back a little bit, because what I think would be important for our listeners, and you mentioned this a little bit, and I'm sure, you know, I've mentioned your name and people may Google it or whatever, but talk a little bit about what informed you, your historical family, talk a little bit about how you have taken that foundation and built a path or found your historical charge, build off of those who had came before. Talk a little bit about that particular development.
Well, for me, as far back as I can remember, I'm just getting exposure to a lot of history. But when it really became real for me was in May 25th, 1979. I was 9 turning 10, and I marched in Africa Liberation Day for the first time. And like 30,000 people, we marched, and we marched all over D.C., and we reassembled in Malcolm X Park. So that was my first political activity. I did it in 1980. I did it all the way up to 1982. They would have to drag me from playing tackle football with my friends or basketball with my friends to make me do it. I resisted it. I resisted the resistance, so to speak. I mean, you know, I was a reflection of my age. But there were certain things I was around. They took, my father was a doctoral candidate at Howard. So I saw Angela Davis when she was there. I saw Amiri Baraka when he was there. But what did it for me when I was 12 turning 13, I saw Achmed Sekou Touré there. And I'm sitting there saying, man, I see the buttons in my house, I see the posters in my house, and here I am in front of him. So I recognize the significance of that. And so after that, the seeds were dropped very early, but I got distracted. And so I grew up in Northwest DC. So I grew up at the height of the crack at PCP cocaine era. So even though I wasn't involved in the blue collar crime wave, so to speak, a lot of people around me were. I almost lost my life at 15, breaking up a fight. And when I was laying there in the hospital, I just had a reflection on everything that I was taught and recognizing that what I was doing on a daily basis had nothing to do with that. So what I had to do is I had to just reconnect myself with the things that were shared with me and I was exposed to so very early. And a year later, the Reagan administration bombed Libya, as we know, April 15, 1986, taking the life of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's two-year-old daughter. So I'm sitting in Calvin Coolidge at my favorite high school, my favorite class, one of the only ones I would go to on a regular basis. And we had, this is when they used to make you stand in front of the class and do current events. So the teacher says, and Obi's going to tell us tomorrow about that madman and terrorist Gaddafi. And I stood in front of the class and told him he was a friend of my family. And the whole class just stopped. And they were like, and I had a reputation for being a class clown. So they thought I was joking. They were laughing. And I said, nah, my family knows him. And that's when I realized that my personal experience was not the norm and what have you. And so I went back and told my dad that I did that, and he told me I shouldn't have done that. And I said, why? And so that was the first political conversation that we had. And when we first got here in 1978, the Libyan embassy was still here because it shut down in 1980. So they actually used to just come and see if we were okay and everything, and how we were adjusting to Washington, D.C., and how was I doing with school and things of that nature. So I always remembered that. And so when Libya got bombed, I'm like, oh, man. And then I'm starting to and then I remember the assassination of Maurice Bishop. I was in the eighth grade. So I remember seeing his pictures around the house or pamphlets around the house. So I had some very important exposure. And so when I came of age and decided that I was going to give my life to the people, I recognize that all the things that you would need to ensure that, because all resistance must have direction, it was being given to me along the way. But what happened was my maturity level caught up with my intellect, which is when an individual comes full circle, so to speak, in terms of maturation. And so I realized that after that, it served me very well. So when it came time to organize with my peers, my contemporaries, I had all that history I was being exposed to fall back on. And because I was exposed to that history, I was motivated and inspired by it. I never was intimidated by it. In a lot of instances, we can find our history intimidating. So you're not supposed to do more than Malcolm. You're not supposed to do more than Martin. You're not supposed to do more than Maurice Bishop. And that's because you're in awe of what they were able to contribute. But history dictates that you expand on their contributions. And if you're going to pursue that path, and that is the path of historical responsibility, the very first thing, and this is part and parcel of the decolonization process, you have to be able to look at what they contributed to, not be intimidated, be inspired, and say, hell yeah, I can expand on all of that. And hopefully you're in a type of organization where the internal dynamics don't frustrate you, the internal dynamics don't overwhelm you, and you can go ahead and get to work. You can go ahead and expand on the contributions of the people whose pictures you've been looking at as long as you can remember, on the books you've been reading as long as you can remember. You can now do for our people what they did in the historical time and space and capsule that they occupied.
Let's talk a little bit about some of those particular experiences, and let's dig a little bit deeper. Here, because I want to, just talk about your time organizing particularly, but also learning, what lessons were important that you learned in the context of organizing, of course, ideology, of course, history, because and what I'm basically saying is that reading, these things are, if you're fortunate enough to live or grow up in proximity to these, doesn't necessitate purpose. Right. So I'm really trying to, kind of unpack or give our listeners, a really full, as much as possible, a genealogy here. Like, how do we understand that genealogy?
It goes back to what we were saying, because, I come on the tail end of what's called the anti-apartheid movement. And for us, the anti-apartheid movement in this country goes back to the 1930s. It did not start in 1977. As some people would have us believe. No, the Council of African Affairs, when Paul Robeson and Du Bois were in the leadership, started dealing with ANC. Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee went to prison protesting. Canada Lee, the great actor, was dragged off the NAACP stage after making the movie Cry the Beloved Country, saying that we should be more involved. Albert Luthuli makes a connection with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference after the ANC organizes a bus boycott. That's number one. But we come in the tail end. I'm 51 now. So we helped organize the funeral of Zephaniah Motsepane, one of the most important figures in the history of the Pan-Africanist Congress of Azania. His funeral was at St. Augustine Church on 14th and V Street in Northwest. So we helped the local PAC people, the late Dr. Nana Shishibe, and others help get organizations in our community to come there and share their respects. And the reason that we did that is because we know that many people under the guise of anti-apartheid work, they were doing ANC support work. They wouldn't touch PAC, they wouldn't touch AZAPO, but we felt an obligation to organize with all three. So that right there, so just understanding, that's an example of study. We weren't, even though the ANC was our oldest liberation movement starting in 1912, and we know what they contributed, we understood that the PAC was created by the ANC's Youth League. Mangaliso Sobukwe was the leader of the ANC's Youth League and took Zephaniah Motsepane and Nati Pokela and Clarence Makwethu and David Mapuzana Sebeko and Elizabeth Sebeko and those comrades with him, because they wanted the issue of land to be the primary focus of the struggle in what is called South Africa, what they call Azania. And then the young people who came after them, their children, they wanted to continue their work because they didn't see, both the ANC and PAC had very limited exposure during those exile years. So it's the South African Student Organization, ushers and BCMA. So because we felt a sense of connection, we had a different strategic approach. We weren't just going to work with ANC and go in hiding when PAC and Azapo came for help. So because we had that history, because we had that foundation, because we had that understanding, we recognized the strategic importance of working with all three. The ANC didn't work with us as much because they didn't need us. They had the Congressional Black Caucus. They had Trans Africa. They had the National Baptist Convention. They had the National Newspaper Publishers Association. It is the PAC and BCMA who, because they got used to functioning like guerrillas, they were the ones that came to those of us in the student movement. They came to those of us in the nationalist movement so that they could gain some traction, so that they could gain some support as well. But because we knew the history and we knew the engagement dynamics around that, we calculated and recognized that we should work with all three. I hope that's the type of example that you were looking for in terms of something practical that you study in terms of study strategic engagement and study historical significance. So that's just one, but we got many examples like that. And that's how we've always moved. You know what I mean? It's always been a thing where let's take a look at the history, let's take a look at the current development, and then let's see what we can contribute on a practical level.
And that is exactly what is important in the context. And let's link that to where your work has evolved, particularly looking at that, but still in the continuity of using history. Let's talk about your work, particularly in Cuba. Let's talk about that in the context of a bridge here, which is you also one of the tools that you use for understanding how to advance struggle, particularly African or Africana struggle, is being a journalist, right? Is one of the many. You're a history teacher, African history teacher. But could you talk a little bit about
the journalism,
the journalism, and then moving that to centering Cuba in the work that you have been doing as well?
Okay. Well, with the journalism piece, that comes through the Zimbabwe work. What ended up happening is in 2002, right after the presidential elections, which is 2 years after ZANU-PF's land reclamation program and 3 years after Operation Sovereign Legitimacy, where Zimbabwe, Angola, and Namibia's militaries fight off Susan Rice's attempt to establish the reinvasion of the Congo to reinstall Mobutu's network in power to keep the cycle of military neocolonialism in perpetual motion. So that was one thing we looked at and said, we got it, something has to be done. Also, then the land reclamation program. But the way we were looking at it then was, we realized that in addition to attempting to reduce the struggle in what's called South Africa to the autobiographies of Nelson Mandela and Winnie Mandela, it didn't stop there. There was a deliberate attempt by our enemies to reduce the whole struggle of Southern Africa to them. But being here in DC and looking at the local politics of DC and understanding that Marion Barry wins the first election for mayor in 1978, there's a lineage and a connection. You're saying genealogy. So Mozambique and Angola get their independence in 74, 75. Zimbabwe gets their independence in 80. Namibia gets their independence in 90. What's called South Africa gets its independence in 1994. So what happens is we say, wow, we're invested with PAC, we are. We're invested with Azapo, we are. But Zimbabwe needs us, Namibia needs us, Mozambique needs us, Angola needs us, Southern Africa needs us, because based on our study at that time, Southern Africa still is the most stable region on the African continent. West Africa is, at the governmental level, is plagued with neocolonialist governments. Eastern Africa is plagued with instability and chaos. And Northern Africa, because of the colonialist and imperialist definitions that have been shoved down our throats that we accept, we don't even consider that part of Africa. That is why the Obama administration strategically went after Libya, not because of Gaddafi and the African Union, like many people say. they knew that the response from Africans in the diaspora would be lukewarm, because we always, as much as Libya did for Africa, whenever we thought about Libya, the overwhelming majority of us, we thought first of the captivity of our ancestors by Arabs. So it was always very challenging to do Libya work. I was involved, the Pan-African Student Youth Movement was the only student youth organization in this country to be part of the Worldwide African Anti-Zionist Front, which was an umbrella that came out of Libya in 1990, and all the nationalist organizations in our community were part of it, except for the Nation of Islam, ironically. And we were the main student organization, youth organization that was part of it. And we worked for 10 years consistently to change the narrative on the Zionist question and to show people that Palestinian solidarity is just the tip of the iceberg, but Zionism is an enemy of the African world. When Algeria became independent, Israel stood up against them at the UN. They did the same thing to Tunisia, and Israel gave military assistance to all of the colonial empires. They helped the Germans in Namibia, ironically. They helped the Portuguese in Angola and Mozambique, and they helped the Rhodesians in Zambia and Zimbabwe to try to stifle the resistance there. So we know that we have a bone with Israel to pick as African people. So that work took 10 years, and then of course it became okay when Jimmy Carter started talking about Israel, because you know many of our people in this country, Brother James, they need to take their cue from a white liberal before they speak courageously, speak contextually, speak truthfully. But we were doing it 10 years before. So that's another example. We got involved in the Worldwide African Anti-Zionist Front because we did our study, and we know that Ethel Miner wrote a paper called The Palestinian Problem that got SNCC involved in anti-Zionist work, which led to them supporting Egypt and Syria during the Six-Day War. We know that Brother Malcolm had a segment in the Muhammad Speaks where they covered the Palestinian question, which the final call has emulated with the Middle East report that Ali Baghdadi has done. That's another example of studying. We know that Brother, and what we used to distribute to get young organizations, student organizations involved in this work, we would distribute Malcolm X's article, Zionist Logic, which he wrote in the Egyptian Gazette in 1964. That's when we recognized that organizer having platforms to write about their work could be very important to us. Then we went back and studied, this is how George Padmore would roll. This is how J.A. Rogers would roll. J.A. Rogers became so good at it that they insisted that he be the one to go and cover Haile Selassie's coronation. When the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey was in jail, they said, you got to talk to somebody. They're butchering you out there. He said, I'll talk to no one but Joel Augustus Rogers. So he wanted to talk to J.A. Rogers to get his words out there to the community. That's when, and of course, we looked at the excellent work of Daisy Bates during the Little Rock Nine. And Ida B. Wells was a force in the movement against lynching because of her journalistic skills. So what happened is, when we started working with the Zimbabweans, when I finally went home, 3 years after having a meeting with the late Pan-African icon and giant, the great Robert Gabriel Mugabe, he said, you know, young brother, you got to come home, and then you can have the type of engagement you're looking for. And you don't strike me as the type of person that just wants an hour when we come to the UN. I said, nah, definitely not. So when we went home, the former ambassador to the UN mission, Tichona Jikonya, who was one of the main people who set up their diplomatic portfolio after independence, he said, what do you do when you are watching the propaganda against us? Do you read the opposition newspapers, or you read the government newspaper? I said, to be honest, he said, yeah. I said, I read the opposition papers first, then I read the government paper second, because I know what the government paper's going to say, but I want to see what the opposition papers are going to say, because I know that's what the people in the U.S. are going to read. I know that's what the people in Jamaica or Haiti or any other part of the Western Hemisphere are going to read, or the U.K. are going to read. And he said, you know, that's the answer I was looking for, because if you would have told me that you don't read our papers, we couldn't use you for what I have in mind for you. I said, what you want me to do? He said, I want you to write a column for the Herald, the national newspaper. And we think that will be very helpful, because the West underestimates our ability to make the transition where information becomes the first line of defense. And he was saying that it's a stereotype they have of guerrilla fighters, that they can't contextualize and they can't be intellectual, that they can just shoot guns or they can just swing a knife. He said, but we're gonna beat them in this propaganda war. And so in 2006, I began. In 2008, they officially made me the first US correspondent. That has historical significance because I'm Nigerian on my father's side. And if you know Zimbabwe's history, after independence, they had to borrow $20 million from the Nigerian government to purchase their paper from some Boers, some colonialists in what's called South Africa. And then they bought their newspaper back. Then they laid the direction of the Herald. So the fact that someone who has Nigerian blood is the U.S. correspondent for them. So that, and then interestingly enough, a few years ago, I had to go to the U.S. Institute of Peace, which is the most powerful imperialist think tank in this country. They tell the State Department what to do with policy. They tell the CIA, the Pentagon, the White House, Congress, the Senate what to do. And they tell the rest of these think tanks, the International Republican Institute, the National Democratic Institute, the National Endowment for Democracy. So when I was sitting there, Johnny Carson, Clinton's former ambassador to Zimbabwe, Obama's spokesperson in African affairs during his first term, he's now the co-chair of that organization, and he's also in the National Democratic Institute. He said Zimbabwe is winning the propaganda war against us, using ragtag journalists who buy into what they believe. And he said that in front of me. So I recognize how this could be very influential. On the Cuban side of things, it's been more about the grassroots organizing. During our time working on the Million Man March, where we worked on the National Youth Organizing Committee, like I said, we went to a meeting one night at All Souls Church on 16th Street, and the Cuban diplomat was there, an African named Jose Ponce Carabello, who is now one of the most powerful people in Cuba's media. And we met him, and we said, we just want to start doing some work with you. So we started working with the Cuban Intersection in 1995. And basically an intersection, for people who don't know, does the same thing that an embassy does, but that's all you have at your disposal when you don't have normalized relations with the country that you're in. So we just fell in line with everyone else. And from that, we did a lot of special things, unique things dealing with Cuba. We convinced the Cuban diplomats in 2003 to start having a reception on African Liberation Day. So that could be used as a platform to come together, to bring together different African organizations.
You were listening to a conversation I recently had with Obi Egbuna Jr. We were exploring history as a tool for organizing. Due to time constraint, you can listen to the entire program on Africa World Now Project's SoundCloud. Just search Africa World Now Project. Thank you to all of our listeners around the world. Share widely and engage deeply with your communities. That's it for Africa World Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africaworldnowproject@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist Moise Mutali, Africa World Now Project media correspondent Funda Ngunda, senior research, content contributor, and production director Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior researcher and content contributor and production associate Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, technology advisor is Byron Gray of GrayWorks Technology, and creative director is Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project is heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC, NPR affiliate and broadcasting service of Winston-Salem State University. Shows are archived weekly on SoundCloud. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent.